Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Meta Lab and welcome to Paraflows and welcome to tonight's panel discussion. What's left behind? The glory of fuck up. Okay. So, digital art, and Paraflows is to a certain extent interested in digital art. So digital art and culture is embedded in the cultural framework of technological developments. In the study of technological development and creativity, focusing attention on the failure, the error, the breakdown, the malfunction means opening the black box of technology. Studies have convincingly demonstrated that the widespread inability to understand technological artifacts as fabricated entities, as social and cultural phenomena, derives from the fact that in retrospect, only those technologies that prove functional for a culture and can be integrated into everyday life are actually left over. So, however, the perception of what is functional, what is successful, what is useful is itself the product of social and cultural and, of course, last but not least, political and economic processes. So, selection processes and abandoned products, abandoned strains of technology, abandoned products are usually not discussed, or if they're discussed, in hack spaces or stuff like that, but not on a big societal scale. So to die, we invited technologists and artists and designers and philosophers here to the Meta Lab, which is a major host of failure. I'd like to introduce Dimitri Kleiner from Berlin, actually a Canadian. So he failed being a Canadian and came to Germany. We have Jane Tingley, who is from Canada, but she actually fails to be still from Winnipeg. Yes, but she moved.
Yeah.
Oh, she fails. She definitely fails to be Canadian because she's from Quebec. That's right. We have Heather Kelly, who is a complete major fail because she's from Florida, and that's the major fail there is. So if you're from Florida,
although if you succeed to escape Florida, I think that could be considered a major success.
But you never can take Florida out of a person. That's no. I'm just teasing. But, I mean, that guy's from Yuma, so, I mean, that's a different thing.
Is that a planet?
It's not a planet. Yeah, but a major fail, by the way, is we only have one microphone, so we have to be very considerate about speaking into the microphone. That guy, Adam Flynn, is a cultural vagabond, I would say, and philosopher. And of course, he's very, very much interested in technological failure, because yesterday he gave a talk about long distance relationship, and that's like one possible like maelstrom of technological failure, I guess. So the basic question today is, there is the wonderful and magic world of abandoned products, the developmental derailments, sobering intermediary results, and useless prototypes. There is failure everywhere, but nobody talks about it. The thing I have in my hand here, the iPhone, I mean, I don't know how many trillions of failures there are in one iPhone. Not in that one I have here, but in like the process of creating something like an iPhone. Technology is in a certain way a very evolutionary process, at least in our very evolutionary capitalist society. But people don't like to talk about that. Although, all the time, there is major, major failure everywhere, especially in a technological media society. We know the blue screen of death. We know that we try to send an email and it just doesn't work. Yesterday, there was an interesting discussion. Would in the early 21st century, would Romeo and Juliet and in an interesting, positive way, because they can just like send text messages and then they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't end up dead or something. Yeah. Would that happen, or what would happen? I guess what would happen is that he or she runs out of minutes for her cell phone and they die because they run out of minutes on their cell phone. That's probably even more tragic than like the courier is not making its way through stupid medieval Italy. I don't know, yeah? So I'm handing now the microphone to Heather Kelly because... Even right at the moment, her piece of media art, or a piece of media art she's highly involved in at the Paraflows exhibition, is not working. It's not working. It worked for 2 or 3 hours at the opening, but it's still not working. And my question would be, A, what it's all about, B, why is it not working, and C, why is it such an interesting thing that you go to Ars Electronica, you go to media art festivals, and the shit is not working? Never! Ever! Why is it not working? And as a digital artist, my basic question would be, why is this so? And is this like something like that's, it's just like media art will never work. I just like postulate this, this thing. Okay.
So I'm the poster child for technological failure of media art. I like that. It should be noted, though, that right now, as far as I know, my piece is the only one that's failing in the Paraflows exhibit, and I didn't see any that were failing at ours. There are? Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. There might have been a few others that had problems, but they're not sitting on the panel. So I don't know where to start, but I have to guess to describe the piece for anybody that hasn't seen it. It's an interactive game that takes place in the gallery space, the White Cube, and uses a bunch of sensors inside of a soft, squishy ball. So it's like maybe soccer, football-sized ball, and it has a it has gyroscopes inside, so it can tell rotation, pressure sensors, so you can tell if you're if it's being squished, pushed. And it has a positioning system, so it knows exactly where it is in the 3D space of the room. And you play a connect the dots type of puzzle where you're looking for an invisible spot in the 3D space following a sound clue that's much like a hotter, colder sound feedback. And when you find it, you can squish the ball, and on a screen and projected on the wall, you see the sort of constellation of stars taking shape, and then it creates an object out of these stars after you find it's 8 or 9 of them. So it's actually rather complex, and it uses like 3 different sensing systems that all have to communicate remotely with the computers that are running the game. And that's why there's a lot of room for failure in the piece. At the moment the main problem was that in the first night of the show, the piece is meant to be rather durable, and it in the first time it got shown, it was like 2 years ago, it seemed to survive fine. But at the opening night, there was a young girl about 8 years old, and she was really amazing. And I was so happy she was there, because she just like got people to play the game that normally would have just been, oh, it's I can't touch that. And she was totally great. And she played for it for about 2 hours solid. And everything was wonderful until the end. It was just like taking so much abuse, so much physical abuse, that it actually started failing. And then when it started failing, of course, she as a player or user didn't know that it wasn't her fault. And so she thought, well, if I just push it harder, it'll respond. And so she did, and to the point where she was actually standing on the object, like putting it, and it has, you know, it's, yes. Yes. Thank you for that was actually fairly accurate. She was
she smiled.
And she was and that was kind of in the, you know, in the hectic moment. And after that, it really wasn't working anymore. And we've tested. It also uses a type of battery, a lithium polymer battery, that if anybody has worked with on models or things that they've done here, is a very small and lightweight battery, but also dangerous and will burst into flames if it's punctured.
She could have died.
Yeah. Yeah. We discovered after opening up the thing that the battery had indeed like deformed, and it was bad news. So like we spent a day going to the Conrad to get new batteries and changing out all the little parts that were all, you know, there's only one of these. The sensor system that's inside of it is all completely custom engineered by an engineer, software and hardware custom engineered. Would be extremely difficult to replicate again, and certainly could not be in the space of the next month where the show's up. So the status right now is that we replaced the battery and that didn't quite work. And then with the help of Marius and Jane and some other people, we've sort of tested some of the connections and kind of got the communication connection working again. But right now it's still not even clear. It isn't fully working. It got working again today when I set it up this morning, and then 4 o'clock I got the report back that it wasn't working anymore. So yeah, that I'm the poster child. I signed up for this panel before all of this happened. So yeah.
Okay.
Was this a setup? Did somebody go and break my art?
It was that drunken Italian man.
Yeah. Did you send the drunken guy?
No. Yeah, in addition, you have to add that there was like this like 80-year-old child like jumping on the ball, and a drunken 80-year-old with a like a walking stick like kicking it in addition. Oh, so it just bong. So he played air hockey with it or something. Which should be okay. Yeah, I mean Windows should be okay, but well, okay. So my question, you didn't really answer it, but I think I should point it to you. The question is, how many media art installations have you seen in your life, and how many of these installations were actually really working?
So like the main thing I'm thinking about are children's museums. You know, you ever been to a children's museum? It's never working. Why? Because children are agents of destruction. And it never works. And even if it's the best concept and it's really cool to play with, they will just get all over it and swarm over it and find some completely innovative way to break it. So, you know, whenever I go to a children's museum, half the things are always broken, and I read the little thing on the side, and I'm like, oh, this probably would have been very interesting if it was actually here and working.
So shouldn't we actually call one laptop per child like one laptop per death rat or something? I don't know. I mean, I posed that question to Dimitri because I'm very interested, because you come from a technological and a programmer side, and so you develop stuff like that. And what's your point of view on like children as like the ultimate beta testers or something? I don't know.
My own children are still too young to really be agents of destruction as far as things. With a one laptop per child program, I think this is a risk when you think about it. Maybe one laptop per child is too much. It could be a slogan for preventing this kind of abuse from going on. I think the answer for why media art never works is really quite simple. Actually, it's complicated, takes a lot of work, and the artists are always in a rush. And
No, well, it's just the fact is we don't have a team of people working on these things and developing them. And like, it doesn't go through years and years of testing and beta testing. It's something that we come up with, we use our resources, we try to figure it out to the best of our abilities, and then something happens, life, and like a kid jumps on it, and you go, oh, lithium polymer batteries need to be protected. So now I know that. So next time that won't be the problem, but something else will be. And it's just the way it is. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
okay. Okay. Then, why are there no like version 2.0s of MediaArt? Usually not, because usually the stuff breaks down, and the thing like the next time we take a better battery never happens, because artists usually get bored with the stuff and never really go to the next level of finishing a new version. My question would be, for Heather now, because Heather already also worked for corporate gaming companies, and like in like the other way, like big teams working on stuff like BioShock 2 and whatever. Yeah. You didn't have whatever. It's like name it whatever. Yeah. The question would be, isn't there lots of interesting, in German we call it fail. What's the fucking German term that I'm looking for? So it's about like it's basic research. It's playing around with stuff. It's Grundlagenforschung. That's the German term. There's Grundlagenforschung. It's research that is pretty much like there is no specific product in sight for that. You just like research for research sake, and then you find out what interesting stuff happens with that. And there is less and less research of that kind around, because most of the corporations who want new products, like specifically hire people to work on a specific problem to find a project for that problem in a certain way. So, and there's less and less like just like playful research out there, but there's lots of playful research in the media art, pretty much. And my question for Heather would be, can you see, you see both sides, like the media art practice and the practice of big corporations. So what's your point on that?
Well, I'm assuming the playful research that gets done would mostly be done within a specific domain. It's like you're interested in a particular area of technology, and then you're playing around with that specifically, not just like, oh, I don't know, I'll just, it couldn't be entirely general. But I've been in situations at big corporations to make games that purported to want to do that kind of research and have even hired me as part of teams to do that. But inevitably, it always got sidelined into something that a customer or a client specifically wanted as an end result or an end product, and stopped being kind of open-ended or driven by the people on the team. It became always sort of exterior, made for somebody else. And yeah, it's really because of the financial situation, as far as I could tell. There's probably some companies that do have the resources to do that. And I mean, it would be great if there was the game company equivalent of Google Labs or something. That might get somewhere for that kind of thing in a corporate situation, but there's currently not, I don't think. I mean, it's hard to know because it's all behind closed doors anyway. There are some smaller game companies that like to do experimentation and research. And they would have to answer for themselves, but most of the experimental stuff and the open-ended stuff I've done was in a university context, because that's just the purpose. That is the purpose of a university, its existence in some ways is to be able to do things that don't have an intentional, like a commercial end result per se, a known commercial end result before you even start the project, and that, people doing original research, it's the value that's upheld. Original, original knowledge, original research is the thing that you want to achieve. So, that's my personal perspective.
Okay. Adam, you're very much interested and do lots of research about like the history of technology in general. Nowadays, we see that universities do less and less of such research, because there's this like neoliberal doctrine of like even at universities, especially in Europe, you can see that there's less and less money for just like open research, and more universities have corporations with corporations and have the same problem now that corporate research labs have. So what's your perspective of like that's maybe a big scale, but what are your what's your perspective of the last like 10-20 years, or did something majorly change?
Yeah, absolutely. We no longer have we no longer have beating the Russians, in the United States, and I mean, in the United States, they underwrote a huge investment in science, in pure science, in science education, technology, engineering, for a generation, because there was this creeping fear that the Russians, they have this pointy-looking ball thing up in space, and it's going beep, and that may have some it may show that so and it enabled people to just sort of they would just throw money at people to go out and research these bizarre things. And you know, you start looking into things like you know, the CIA would occasionally fund people to try and do remote viewing of just thinking really hard that maybe they could see the inside of a missile silo and figure out the plans on it. And you know, that actually, if you look at the history of sort of technology and research in this kind of post-war consensus era, one thing is immediately apparent. It's that before World War II, you have everything is in a silo. You have universities which have this rarefied view of themselves as completely for, you know, educational and pure research purposes. You have businesses which aren't necessarily into research unless they're like, you know, Edison or something. You have, you know, governments which don't really see the point of it that much. And after World War II, you have this kind of broad everybody's in each other's pockets. And I'm thinking this is not necessarily technology, but this is the growth of the communications studies as an academic discipline was absolutely funded by you know, the United States government trying to figure out ways, well, how can we use this? And they actually employed an Austrian, an Austrian sociologist started the modern research bureau, Paul Lazarsfeld. And he was this very entrepreneurial guy who would, you know, try and do his pure research and his instrumental research at the same time. So he would do a survey where he was asking people about their voting behavior, and then at the end they would ask a couple of questions about soap preferences. And so he would sell that data to the soap companies and then publish a book that would completely change people's idea about the media and how it influenced things. And I don't know. There has been, if you look at government funding of pure science and things like, you know, going to the moon, you know, it's just there's not this kind of life or death imperative for it, and so it's, you know, it's part of this general pullback from doing grand things, because in the past doing grand things was a way to make yourself look good and try and, you know, I guess I'm speaking from a very American perspective because that's what I've really looked at, but I don't know.
Okay, Dimitri, you were like, I couldn't like decipher. I failed deciphering your. You were like a little bit nodding, but then again, what is he talking about? Maybe there's some controversy here. I don't know.
Well, I mean, historically, the emergence of the think tanks in America has a lot to do with this degradation of this idea of pure research and pure intelligence, where information becomes made into a protected commodity. So this whole history you have in the universities of peer review and sharing of information and research for research's sake starts to become like, you know, proprietorized, where you have these think tanks that pay the best research engineers and all the research is secret and nobody actually tests it, which opens up, of course, huge possibilities for failure because all of the stuff is made for one company. I think, I don't know if anybody remembers the 80s, but there was the 80s, the 1980s. You've heard of it. It's in Wikipedia. All right. There was a disease called AIDS and when it first came out, people were dying from it from an unbelievable rates. And there's also a drug called AZT that was given to AIDS victims, despite the fact that there actually wasn't any evidence at all that this is useful for AIDS, and actually lots of evidence that it kills people. And actually this drug they tried to sell it for cancer before, apparently. So it was like, we have this patent, right? We spent a lot of money on this patent. It must be good for something. These people are sick. Let's give it to them. right? And this kind of thinking comes from proprietary kind of knowledge. In an open science kind of world, this wouldn't be able to happen because, first of all, anybody can make the drug, so it wouldn't be one company's advantage to push a nonsense drug onto the market. And second of all, people would say, well, actually, we have access to the research and there's actually no evidence this drug is good for this disease, right? So I think that this has a lot to do with sort of degradation of this university culture. The universities are operating that environment, so they have to react to this, and so they become closer and closer, and you have all these things like in U of T there's Mars, and all of these universities are now opening like public-private cooperation like centers where like they invite business people and like different kinds of things into the university in order to try to kind of get back into the scene that the think tanks are operating.
It's interesting thinking about that in relationship to, you know, in the 1960s you had these very tight relationships between top universities and, you know, big companies which were selling things to the government. And so, you know, you get things like, chemistry people at a university working on something that becomes the Agent Orange and gets dropped on Vietnam as a defoliant, the idea being, well, you know, we need something to clear away these jungles so that we can see better and drop bombs on the right people. And that was, you know, in terms of epic fails, you know, Agent Orange ranks among them. But it's systematic of a pattern of like, well, if we knew about the long-term effects, we wouldn't have done it.
Really?
I don't know. At least that's what's that? Thalidomide.
That's
a lot of deformities.
They didn't do it in East Germany. The West Germans apparently tried to push it on the East Germans, saying, "Hey, this is great, like drug. It makes women feel better in the morning or whatever, right?" And the East Germans just totally weren't interested in it because they were like, "Well, we can't be sure what this does. There's no real evidence that it provides anything of use." And so this whole thalidomide baby crisis didn't happen there because it was a different environment.
Question to Jane. You are working at a university. You do research there. You are a part of a couple of projects there. You use university material from time to time to build your own art stuff. Tell us a story about major university fuck up concerning technology and cooperation. Maybe you have an interesting anecdote of what really went wrong.
Where to start? I don't know. I mean, how about just even the new EV building built for Concordia University? It was this building that was not built for people. It was built for the idea of people. And I mean, you have this every third floor, there's no more stairs except the emergency exit because they were trying to create these sort of idealized communities that so that people could, you know, be able to function together during three floors, every three floors, so that's like a 12-story building, and every three floors there's stairs from the 12th to the 11th to the 10th, and then nothing from the 10th to the 9th, except for the emergency escape, like the emergency stairs. You have to take, well, you could take the elevator. So people take the elevator from one floor to the next. It's the bathrooms are smart bathrooms, yet whenever you're going in there, the toilets are perpetually flushing. Water's constantly pouring out. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on.
The fact that there's no sink to like even get water to put in a tea kettle. There's like my big beef with it is that there's no kitchen. If they want to create community, why not put a place where people could actually prepare food?
They have a kitchen, but you have to ask.
Oh, yeah.
They have a kitchen, but you have to ask security to let you in, and it takes a couple of hours to get security. How about this one? The panel discussion with Interstices. We had this really big panel discussion with Electra Festival. Every single request that I made from opening of the terrace, like they have beautiful terraces, but nobody's allowed on them because Somebody might jump. Or, I don't know, like maybe they'll smoke or something. I mean, it's... So it was one fuck up after another. I mean, the couches I applied, asked for didn't arrive. The terrace didn't get open. We have all these international guests waiting to get to smoke on the terrace. And I'm just like, we're talking to security in a very nice way. And they're saying, but I didn't get the email. And we're like, okay, we don't care about whether or not you got the email at this point. Can we just open the terrace? And it took... I think people got on the terrace for the last 10 minutes, so.
Maybe we could talk about the social side of technological failure. I think that's a good segue.
Yes.
The social side of technological failure. Well, okay. I asked all of you for a statement yesterday because I wanted to publish a short announcement on FM4 on the website. And Dimitri had, of course, this old-time favorite slogan of something like, if you really want to fuck up, you need a computer or something like that. That's this old cliche, but actually it's kind of okay. I mean, you also could fuck up with a nuclear bomb, I guess. But more people have computers than nuclear bombs. Okay. So... my question would be the social side of failure is always how do you define what is a failure and what not, and to a certain extent. I mean, what you're talking about is that there is some kind of like interesting directive. They build a building, the building does not work, and that's why people are actually suffering and there is major social loss. But then again, I mean, I see it here in the Meta Lab. Sometimes there is actually crazy stuff going on and it does not work, but it actually glues people together. So if like Heather's machine is not working, there are suddenly like five people standing around and having good advice. Most of the people just don't know what they're talking about. But still, it's the social glue of I know better because your stuff is broken, okay? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, the social glue of dick waving. That's right. That's a very hackerish thing to do, Adam.
Your question?
No. Okay. Now my question would be the social glue of a failure. Have you experienced the social glue of a failure?
Yes. During my talk yesterday, part of the talk was a differentiation between, technology failure and sort of personal failure in maintaining a long distance relationship. And the nice thing is that technology failure, or if you can be clear and understand that something is a technology-based or technical failure, or you can blame it on the technology, that's actually a really nice thing because you can sort of feel like this kind of nice persecution complex that like, the technology is against me, but I am still reaching out for you. And whereas a personal failure is extremely poisonous to a long distance relationship, a technology failure can indeed bring people closer together with this kind of a dramatic feeling of against all odds, we are trying to make this connection.
Okay. My question for Dimitri would be, something like Linux and open source software, is that like, I mean, that's a major maelstrom of fuck up. At the same time, it's pretty working. I mean, there is something like a working Ubuntu and pray to God. Yeah, but okay. The question would be, is the social glue a failure that somehow ended up in something like open source software? Is that something that should be milked in other areas of technology too, or did it derive from failure of like Windows or proprietary software systems? I don't know.
I mean, well, I think the role of failure and experimentation, I mean, like progress demands failure, right? It's in not only in free software but in everything. The scientific method is trial and error is so, and most artists in their practice employ failure. So I think that's certainly not something that can be isolated to free software, but it's certainly something that in free software is very prominent, especially because the free software community and the internet kind of grows together and comes together. And so communication is an essential part of the whole free software community. And then the emergence of spaces like MetaLab. So I think there's just a lot of social around the free software. And because it's kind of like, you know, it's made by people that need it rather than companies that are trying to sell it, there's a lot of kind of itch scratching. So there's a lot of, this doesn't work, we need to make this work. And so there's a lot of community activity around making things work.
I mean, like, it's just the spider and the starfish thing, you know, with the communities that are allowed to just sort of grow on their own, and people are inherently creative and they want to help each other, I think. And I mean, you know, you cut off one leg and it sprouts another starfish, or it grows another one back. I mean, it's the way it works, I think, in these types of communities where something doesn't work and something else shows up, and people help us help each other because people want to help, and people from all over. It's insane. Like, even the pure data community, people are coming up with little patches to help people out, to come up with plugins so that they can use this program with Linux. And it's really quite astonishing, that level of willingness.
I think my failed artwork is a case in point in that both before I left Montreal and after coming here, because people have definitely, you know, once I kind of foolishly decided, not really knowing how insane it was to like try to bring it over here, people were very happy to offer their help, and so yeah, I think it totally. I mean, I would have agreed anyway, but I certainly feel it especially right now. So yeah, it can bring people together if it's something you can all jointly point your finger at, and yeah.
Interestingly enough, John Dewey, the sort of educational theorist, democratic philosopher, he had this idea that the communities and publics only really come together and become conscious of themselves as a community when they're responding to a failure in the existing systems, that there has to be some sort of thing that pushes them to fix it, or else it's not really a public or not really a community.
Okay, some communities, especially the open source community, I know people in the open source community who do not talk to each other because they use different operating systems. They're just like, you know, I will not talk to you, you use SUSE. What the fuck, go away. Blah, 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 blah. And there's lots of like stuff like that happening. Of course, there's always a certain amount of, in German we'd call it Distinktionsgewinn. So the power of distinction, the power of like, I'm different than you, and because I'm different than you, like I have my own posse, and I deal with my own fuck up. Don't touch my fuck up, okay? To a certain extent. So it seems that humans always find a way around like not helping other people in certain cases.
One thing about technology bringing people together is that at least it's something concrete and it probably can be solved. And I think there's a really big power in that. It's not ephemeral or a sort of philosophical difference. It's just, it's very real, and therefore people can sort of together help each other to actually accomplish something. And so I think it attracts that sort of interaction for that reason.
So I would like to start a new round, whatever. I think we didn't even have a round before that. We're just like babbling around. Okay, I would like your favorite anecdotes, your personal favorite anecdotes. The stories could be personal that you experienced them or you have heard about them, about technological failure and fuck up. Okay, what's your personal story that you would tell, because it's so beautiful?
From personal experience or just something, a favorite story?
It could also be something you've read about. Okay.
Well, the one that immediately comes to mind, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it was about a Korean airline that crashed, and they went to the black box. They went to go, why is this plane crashing? And what happened was they were flying, and the captain made a mistake. And the co-pilot said, you know, you might want to check this valve over here. There's sort of a problem. And the captain's and the co-pilot just sort of dropped it, because in Korean culture, you don't question your superior. The captain is considered to be the higher authority than you. He knows better. And so, you know, you just let it drop, and then it crashed. And this happened more than once. So they actually had to sort of retrain the pilots this particular tweak to make them, you know, they could be Korean in every other respect, but once they got into the cockpit, you know, they had to drop that part, and the co-pilot had to say, I'm stepping in and taking control of the plane when it needs to happen.
That's a nice example of like the human error. Like if like some plane crashes, it can be like a technical malfunction or it can be human error, and that's something in between, I guess. Yeah. Okay.
I haven't really come up with one as a favorite. I can't help thinking of that video of that one bridge that like had some kind of, was it there a, like an earthquake and it, or the wind vibrated it at a specific resonant frequency and it just like exploded or like, I just keep remembering that picture of that bridge going like, ooh, yeah. I it's very visually stunning, but I wouldn't call it a favorite, you know, it's like, that's rough.
Yeah, if you really enjoy sort of visuals like that, there's this program on the Discovery Channel, it's called Destroyed in Seconds, and essentially it's just exploits our desire to watch things fail horribly, and it's like buildings collapsing or like boats flipping over and exploding, or
it's like the fail blog of television.
Yeah, it's like the kind of you know, technological catastrophe money shot, in other words.
Do they actually speed them all up so that they, you know, happen way faster than?
It's things that happen very quickly. So like you know, there's something where it bursts into flame or collapses or shatters, and in fact sometimes they slow it down. Yeah. So you can really savor the destruction.
Okay, that destruction porn. Let's call it. Okay, Jane.
Well, something just popped into my mind when you started talking about yours. This one is just, I don't know, it's kind of mental. It's this bottle that was developed in Australia, and it had the same texture as a particular type of beetle. And the beetle, of course, the male beetle tries to mate with the largest female beetle possible. And of course, these bottles were far larger than any female beetle. And so, of course, these bugs were trying to, you know, procreate with these bottles, and they almost went extinct, and then they had to actually change the texture of the bottle in order to allow for this beetle to continue surviving. So
I don't know, I've got a couple I could think of. There's from a software world, there's one that I was told by a Russian software engineer that's sort of like kind of, you know, a failure to think things through. And so he was hired by this Russian factory to make an inventory system, which seems like a reasonable thing to do. And so a lot of programmers worked very hard on developing this really good inventory system that had all the things and the components in the inventory were all scanned in. And the thing worked really well, and it was unveiled to the management. And they quickly realized that with this inventory system, we know exactly what we have in this factory, which means that our workers can't steal stuff. And if they can't steal stuff, they're not going to come to work because we don't we don't actually really pay them, right? Because there's a song. And so they sold the entire system, computers and all, unplugged it, took it out, sold it, moved it on. It's not a personal story, but it was told to me.
They could have just programmed in the loss, like an automatic thing where a certain percentage would just be disappearing from the system. That's easy. Well, anyway.
I feel like...
There's one failure I really like, although it's not it's a combination of like a political failure and a failure of technology. Although it was actually not the problem of the technology. In the time before the right wing's pretty much killed Allende in Chile in 1973, I guess. They actually had a working planned economy system based on telephone lines and cybernetics. They had a company design a working planned economy based on some kind of like internet cyber technology, and it was in place. They wanted to start. It could actually really have worked. And then they killed all of them, and it never was tested, and it never was turned on, in fact. And that's one of the fails I really hate, because I really would have liked to see that system work. But you know, like then we had a couple of assholes like Kissinger, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for killing half of a nation, to not see that work. So yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting avenue of fail is things that could have been, you know, the sorts of things that are like these amazing prototypes or things that people tried but never quite got off the ground. There's a lot of interesting stuff in sort of like dead media, you know, things that never took off or invented at the wrong time, like the teleharmonium. Which okay. So the teleharmonium was this idea that, well, wait a minute here. If we look at the telephone, it's their electrical signals. So why don't we just create a musical instrument that's going to send electrical signals through the phone and create music? And we can create Muzak. You know, the idea of this sort of music that you could play in department stores or in someone's home. And it was like big as a house. I believe it was like the first electronic instrument. And yeah, a gigantic thing. And I don't know, nobody really wanted it, right? Or
nobody could afford it. It was pretty much like, I think it was constructed as a really big, like a train wagon or something like that. I mean, they were actually planning stuff like building railroad tracks to music halls. They could actually move the thing into music halls and have concerts there with this thing. And of course, I mean, how? But yes, it's like that. That's like the real. That's it's almost like Fitzcarraldo, if you know Fitzcarraldo. It's almost like Fitzcarraldo. Some crazy guy wants an opera house somewhere in the middle of the fucking jungle. But that's even more creative, I guess. Like creating like a railroad system for this like stupid instrument.
When you mentioned. I mean, I guess when you mentioned railroad system, the thought sprang to mind I recently went to go see a fortress of the Maginot Line, which is a great example of a technological and sort of failure in a military sense, because they were these masterpieces of military defense. You know, none of them. Or at least very few of them were ever really assaulted by the Germans, because they worked at what they did. There were these amazing things. They had their own. I went to a fortress. It had its own narrow gauge railroad to deliver ammo from the base to the blockhouses. They had overpressure ventilation systems to protect themselves from poison gas. They had their own kitchen. They had recreation rooms with little cartoons of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves drawn on them. They had a 3-month supply of food like delivered. The officers had like red wine and brandy, a 3-month supply of that. You know, this fortress, it only surrendered like a week after all of France sort of surrendered, and only at the orders of the French general staff. The reason that it didn't work, it didn't protect, was because, it was part of this line of fortresses that extended into Belgium. And there was this big fortress in Belgium that was eminently prepared to withstand an attack by conventional means. But the Germans staged the first ever glider assault in history. nobody ever saw this coming. They just, it was this big fortress, but unfortunately it was extremely flat. And they just landed the gliders on top of the fortress and marched down in and took the fort. And moved through Belgium, and the rest was history, I guess.
Making me think of the railway, I think it was in 1997 or something, the British had designed this beautiful train that was supposed to be kind of like the Eurostar, and it had like beautiful rooms, golden fixtures, showers, and of course this was all designed so you could have luxury travel from England to the rest of Europe. And then at that particular time, that's when all the cheap airlines started happening, and it just became ridiculous because the price for these tickets were so high that nobody would use it. And so this thing never got used, never pulled out, and it's still sitting in the place that it was built. And it's all because of the bad timing thing. So,
but that might be an interesting question for Dimitri, because there is technological failure and there is the failure of the market, let's call it that way, because there are actually people dying in Britain because the rail system got privatized. And it's actually not that like the Britons have like a bad rail system and that kills people. No, it's just like that they're just like cutting down funds for actually running it and maintaining it and stuff. Maybe a little bit about that.
It's fun to make fun of the British, but it also happened in Germany, right? Because the S-Bahn in Berlin was shut down to the point where only two vehicles were allowed to run, because they did an inspection on, and the Deutsche Bahn is also partially privatized, and they didn't spend any money on the maintenance of the S-Bahn system. And when it was years between inspections, when the government finally inspected the fleet, they pretty much shut down the entire Berlin S-Bahn. There was like two S-Bahn cars that were allowed to run in the whole city. And that was only like a year ago, right? And in Munich, you have the central S-Bahn line shares the same tracks with the regional Bahn line, and so like if any one vehicle fails, the entire central line is down because there's only one set of tracks. I think that of course the market is going to try to maximize profit, and you know there's certainly examples where competition is a good impetus. So there's examples where you can say that competition increases the performance of a given market. But rail is a really weird thing to have competition in, because are you really going to move if you don't like your train company, right? You can say, I don't like my train company, I'm going to move, right? Or I'm going to change my job. I'm like, I don't want to work there anymore because I don't like the train company. Otherwise, I like my job. But, you know, it doesn't really make sense to have, like, competition in areas where there's not really a lot of natural flexibility in the market. I think social failure has to go beyond market failure. I mean, like, especially in the area of technology, because a lot of the equipment that we have that actually doesn't fail at all, that works just fine, causes a lot of damage in terms of the poisons used and the production and like the recycling process, the poisons and the exploitation that happens in the on the other side of it. So I think it's, even when the market functions successfully in delivering us very nice working technology right on time, that doesn't mean that there's a larger social failure that's happening in terms of like children are being poisoned in Africa, taking apart the technology that we throw away, and China is being poisoned and Indonesia is being poisoned to build it in the first place.
I kind of wish that my phone was made of like some sort of bioplastic that would slowly degrade. Or that I would have some sort of really nice use for it. Like if I had if Coke cans could be used like Legos once you were done with them. I mean, yeah, and that may be just a failure to consider the whole process of something from the way it's created to what comes afterwards. There's a lot of talk about focusing on the experience, but what about the experience of this as an item of trash? You know, how many architects think about what their building is going to look like as ruins? Or, yeah, Speer did. And that's why everything was like really, really heavy concrete. I went to see some of the bunkers that had been shelled in D-Day. And, In one area, they left the landscape as it was, with all of these like massive craters caused by these gigantic battleship guns. And that said, the bunkers looked pretty good. Like, the, you pour enough concrete on something, and you know, it's not going to fail in that regard. There's, it's just going to fail in some other way.
Let's go back to the History Channel. It's like it's major bourgeois trash. I really like the History Channel. It's really great. It's primarily targeted, I guess, at people 45 plus, but it's okay. And they have one series. It's called Earth After People. So they just take buildings, or they take cities, and then they explain. There's lots of course, popular science about, let's say, what will happen to Houston, Texas, if people would suddenly disappear, and what would happen to the oil fields there? Would they burn? What would happen? Blah blah blah. And it's, I really highly recommend it. Like, download it on Pirate Bay if it is working. And there's one example that the only building that will be left of human civilization in around 10,000 years will be the Hoover Dam. And even the Hoover Dam, after like around like 10,000 years, will pretty much like crumble and collapse and just like bonk and silt over it, and then it will be gone. And there are these nice computer effects of like, so that's how New York looks now, and that's how it will look like in 4,000 years. Snap. And then you see that, like, pretty much like the giant skyscrapers like collide and form new hills. And it's actually pretty nice. I would like to see that. Interestingly, the same, and they always, in pretty much every episode, they talk about Chernobyl. Because Chernobyl is an interesting aspect of, like, we can see what really will happen if there is a pretty large area completely abandoned by people for 20, 30 years, stuff like that. And, of course, Chernobyl is one of the major, major fails of the 20th century. So it's actually my favorite, only maybe like slightly followed by the Challenger explosion. But Challenger explosion and Chernobyl are my favorite major fails of the 20th century. Yeah? Maybe you have other interesting major fails that you would like to mention.
I just liked... There were certain aspects in the details of the kind of error reporting of what happened at Three Mile Island, where it was like there was this valve that was open and letting water out of the nuclear reactor, and they said, okay, you know, we close the valve, and there's a little light blinking that says that the valve is heated, or that there's still water running through the valve. And they think, well, you know, maybe it's a faulty light. And they run through their other processes, and there's still something telling them that this valve is open. But they're like, well, you know, there are some leaks. So based on an earlier small failure, they don't think that there's a bigger failure going on. They knew it to have been leaky before, and this is the other thing about the Deepwater Horizon, the BP oil rig, right? Because they turned off the alarms because the false alarms kept going off and waking everybody up, and I'm like, ah, fucking alarm, and they just turn it off because, you know, if this is a classic principle, is if it, you know. If you have too many false alarms, it's the boy who cried wolf. But yeah, so they just were just like, this alarm won't tell me anything. Turn it off, and I'm going back to sleep.
Heather,
I was so interested and involved in listening to that failure that I wasn't working on thinking of my own failure. Plus, you already took like four or five of the best. I mean, how can I? I mean, I would say Challenger, but you know,
why? Explain.
Well,
why is it so beautiful or so interesting?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is because I was in Florida, so I kind of looked up and I could see it, and so I have sort of weird personal connection to it. I was in high school, in fact, and yeah, it was really strange. But I think also the aftermath of trying the public process of trying to figure out why it had failed and actually having oh man, I'm really embarrassed. I'm forgetting the name of the scientist, the one who did the experiment where he showed, like, he dropped the things into the water and he showed, like, why the O-rings had destroyed. And yeah, no, Feynman, Richard Feynman. Thank you. And just the whole, like, the way that that was handled and the fact that it sort of took this showmanship to kind of prove and to the world what had actually gone on, and then sort of the shame of that. But anyway, so yeah.
I just can't stop thinking about actually Chernobyl and sort of what's happening right now. There's an artist named David McMillan, and I showed one of the images with my talk, and he's sort of showing what the result is of Chernobyl and nature taking over technology, and sort of seeing the reverse and seeing these massive trees growing right through playgrounds, through walls, and just, I don't know, I just got this image, and the work is really interesting, and I think it's worthwhile taking a look at it, but I'm not really thinking about my own examples, so I'll just pass it to you.
I don't know if everybody remembers Geraldo Rivera. Yes. Geraldo Rivera, remember the? He did this grand television special in like the early '90s, I believe. Al Capone's Vaults. That's got to be my favorite. Where it was like live television broadcast. He had found Al Capone's vaults, and he was going to open them live on television and on a major network, and like millions of people had tuned in to see what was in Al Capone's vaults, and there was nothing. There was nothing in there. It was like absolutely empty. There was national television.
For bonus points, Geraldo also got deported from Iraq when he was like gave away the unit's like position on television, like live television, just drew it out on the ground, and like we're right here, yeah, right now, this is what we're doing, and it was just like, you know. Endangering the lives of everyone around him so that he could look cooler on TV.
When he redeemed himself in Katrina, I think. Oh. Remember when he was like...
Well, when he was reporting from the stadium, the sports stadium there, and he was like live on Fox TV, which, as most people know, is a very reactionary television station. And so the primary discourse on Fox TV was all like, you know, oh, these looters are bad, and it was very kind of negative, hateful kind of a discourse. But Geraldo was there and doing a live broadcast, and actually trapped in the stadium with lots of other people, and just like he just kind of went nuts and was going like crazy and like almost crying and saying, what's going on here? Why isn't anybody here helping these people? And it was really very dramatic television moment that I'm sure was not the way Fox TV would have scripted it otherwise.
But that's an example of another fuck up. Is the what happened with New Orleans and just the I mean.
Do you want? I was, you know, that also made me think of failures to control scripted media events, and specifically with Katrina, you had, you know, the Katrina benefit, shortly afterwards, in which Kanye West just said point blank, George Bush does not care about black people. And then you see the look on the face of Mike Myers, and it's incredible.
No, but just in terms of the what's that called, the levy, yeah, and just sort of allowing the financial aspect of it to get in the way of actually building something that functions.
I remember you posted something once about this Russian rocket launch.
Oh my God. I completely forgot my really favorite fuck up. Thanks for reminding me. I actually forgot what's the name. Someone could Google it. Google for like Russian rocket 60s explosion, and it's somewhat incident, and it's the name of the Russian general kind of observing the early tests of the Soviet space program. And but Nedelin incident. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Wonderful stuff. They had this like giant rocket full of highly toxic material, and they were kind of like, he wanted to to launch the rocket the next day because it was it would have been interesting for Khrushchev because of some kind of like anniversary of something, and he really wanted to lift that thing up. And the people were not and his coworkers, they were a little bit afraid of the whole situation and didn't want to rush through the whole thing. But he was saying, no, that's completely fine. And he was sitting next to the rocket on a chair, smoking a cigarette and demonstrating that it's all fine, it's all good, let's go on working, blah blah blah. And then they did a test of the engine system, and they just had this like flip switch, and they just wanted to test if the flip switch would theoretically like ignite the rocket. And because of some major fuck up, they just like started the rocket. And it exploded, and it killed like 50% of all the Soviet rocket scientists of that time. And it's one of the this incident is probably the main reason why the Soviets did not make it to the moon before the Americans in 1969, because they literally killed all their ingenuity in one flash, because one guy was saying, "Oh, come on, I'll sit here and smoke a cigarette. It's all fine. Come on, test it." Everything's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting sort of what you were talking about, sort of the aftermath of Challenger and this kind of, well, how did this happen and where did we go wrong? Because there's this element of hindsight and kind of superiority to these things of failure. Like, oh, ha, 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 look at those jerks. You know, it's the feeling that you get when you're looking at like all those film clips of like early aviation. The guy who was like, oh, I'm going to, you know, this is just... Yeah, I'm going to flap my arms, or I'm going to build the poor man's aircraft that will be powered by human power alone, or any number of these things that fail. And we're like, look at those guys. They don't know what they're doing. But I mean,
Well, I'm remembering that in the case of the Challenger disaster, they also discovered that it was also the information design and the communication and the bureaucracy of how the technology was communicated within NASA and how bad it was. And they'd done tests on the O-rings before, but the demonstrations, the way the evidence was explained to other people was extremely not elucidating. It was like very hard to understand. And after that, I think there was a lot of more interest in information design and how do we make things like actually make sense. We have the data, but how do we show what it means? So was there a...
Somebody was saying that somebody blamed the Challenger disaster on Microsoft PowerPoint. Because like ever since the advent of Microsoft PowerPoint,
Columbia,
because of the what it does to communication, where you have this kind of bulletization of communication, where people put some bullet points up on a wall and they talk and talk and talk. People don't really listen to what they're saying, and they kind of like jot down some of the bullet points and move on. So it's part of the reason for the communication challenge. Problems were allegedly because of Microsoft PowerPoint, which I'm sure everybody here is an enthusiastic user of. But I think maybe we should continue with what Adam was talking about, because it's also interesting as to why do we think failure is interesting and funny? Like what is it about it that makes it something that we like to laugh about? I mean, there's a feeling of superiority as Adam was saying. What else is about it? Why is failure so funny?
It's like the most human of all activities. Can you call failure an activity? I don't know.
Yeah. Conditions. You know, a great man slips on a banana peel. That's funny.
Keyboard cat. That I'm seeing.
Failure. That's success. Great success.
That's right. If you laugh at keyboard cat instead of I don't know. Whatever. But I guess you know Keyboard Cat. I don't have to explain what Keyboard Cat is. Keyboard Cat is one of the major internet memes when I think it's a film from the 1980s of some guy like holding his cat in a way that it looks like the cat would play a funny song. And it turned out that people really liked it to use the keyboard cat as a fail indication. So they were so the video starts with the cat waiting with his like paws. And people started taking videos of bizarre, like, cycling accidents and failure of technology and people breaking their legs and whatever, but in a very stupid way. So you kind of don't feel pity for the people. It's just like, come on, that's a fuck up, yeah? And you see the cat waiting, and you see the people, the person doing something, cycling or being stupid, and you see the cat waiting, and you see the cat waiting, and the people fail, and then the cat is playing the funny song. And it's really interesting stuff, like, I don't know, like handicapped people fall, like in their wheelchairs falling down an escalator and stuff like that. So stuff that's really, really, really wrong to laugh about and pathetic, but the keyboard cat makes it all good.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the category of things that you feel wrong to laugh at, and there's also things that you feel right to laugh at, because there's some element of failure is like that the proud and the mighty are getting their comeuppance, yeah, because they're so arrogant and they don't think about these things, and isn't it ridiculous? So you know, now pride cometh before the fall.
I have nothing more to say.
I also, another thread that I think we can pick up longer is on this kind of finding uses for old technology instead of kind of throwing it out and recycling it. And like, any good stories of that? One thing that you notice as a North American coming to Europe is that Europeans have no need for bottle openers. They open bottles with anything, cigarette lighters, highlight markers, like edges of tables, like, and teeth. And so it seems to be like anything can be an opener here. An Italian woman that I know has an old BlackBerry in her house. And this BlackBerry actually doesn't function anymore. It hasn't functioned in years. The reason that she hasn't thrown it out is because she uses it as a bottle opener. She uses it to open beer. That's why it's in her house. That's the only reason she still has it. So what else? What other good uses for technology could we have to prevent it from being, you know, radioactive trash?
Okay. So my last statement, and then I would like to open up to the public, because I'm pretty sure there are really interesting stories about failure out there that we would like to hear. There is this wonderful, we could say that like 9/11 is one major fuck up consistent of many, many, many small micro fuck ups. Like, for example, that the CIA and the FBI were primarily dealing with themselves than with external enemies or stuff like that. They were just like fighting each other after the end of the Cold War because they were thinking, well, our job is done anyways. Now we can. The most horrible thing that could happen for an FBI or a CIA agent was in the 1990s being transferred from CIA to FBI or from FBI to CIA. That was the most horrible thing that could happen to them. That's what they were thinking about. There's a really interesting documentary about the story of the CIA and the FBI in the 80s and 1990s, and it's really like one major fail what they did. And so 9/11, there's one way to see 9/11. Of course, it's a major conspiracy. There's so many factors that are unbelievable, and the thermite and blah, 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 blah. At the same time, there's this wonderful saying by the Chaos Communication Congress or Chaos Computer Club. They say, es ist fast nie Verschwörung, sondern meistens Verpeilung, which means it's seldomly conspiracy. Most of the time, it's fuck up. Okay, which is actually pretty cool for a hacker organization. And hackers are primarily paranoid about life itself. Yeah. So, well. So how? Yeah.
Okay. A starting issue. I mean, the whole dialogue about how are we going to reform the intelligence community, that sort of thing. I happened to watch the film True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
As research before you came here?
Well, not specifically, but like the thing is, he's in like the NSA or something, some super spy organization, and it's the 1990s, and he blatantly misuses the resources of the intelligence community to spy on his wife and mobilizes all these resources to get some way that he can, like, you know, have sex with his wife. Like, that's what the intelligence community was apparently doing during the 1990s. I don't know. It's true lies. Yeah.
He's not a government.
But I mean, there's the whole thing about, like, the false alarms and not enough false alarms. Like, if you know, the whole idea, they weren't talking to each other. Well, if they don't talk to each other, then you have separate flows of information. And when you're a decision maker, you can compare these two and look at them critically. And if everybody's talking to each other, maybe you get groupthink. I don't know. There's just this weird spectrum of failure. There are many different ways to fail. And so in the hindsight, you know, you're always trying to prevent the last accident. So in hindsight, fixing one failure may set you up for others.
Okay, if there are no comments, let's open it up. Okay, we want to hear your fail stories or your fail comments.
Can we have water for the speakers?
Yeah. Okay, but first someone has to raise his or her hand, and then I can get water. I will not get water before someone... Yes. Ah, yeah, there. Okay, that's good. Thank you. And you're actually working, or you were working, designing, like, washing machine interfaces. I mean, that's something interesting.
Yes, I'm going to tell you about that. So, I have made some notes. I need to get to the page. Yeah, so I used to work for Whirlpool, and so, like, I wanted to, like, start by saying that seasons change, and seasonal change is good, but changing a washing machine every 2,000 seasons is absolutely not good. You know, and this is the philosophy, you know, when appliances go bad, people first blame themselves. They believe that the machine is right because, in a very sick way, they believe that it's capable of thinking, so it's probably doing something that they do not know. And so, you know, there's this idea of threshold of pain. And the interesting thing is that the appliance manufacturers are aware of this. And they make the appliances just a little beyond the threshold of pain. And then the machines go bad in any case. So then you're stuck with the idea about what do you do? Do you repair it? Do you buy a new one? But repairing is too much of a trouble. It's very difficult. So I would rather just buy it, a new one, you know. So the old one, which probably can be repaired, goes into the junkyard. The good thing for the appliance manufacturers is that their whole process continues. You know, the interesting thing is that is another play on the psychology, is failure and function. Hey, so you paid 100 euros, you're going to get 200 failures. If you want less failures, you pay 200 euros. But how can they ensure that they will increase the number of functions? You know, so there is this, and then what happens? Somebody says, but I have a bloody washing machine, you know, what am I going to do? Ah, now we are going to make sure that you're going to be able to upgrade your washing machine in the future. So you keep getting into this amazing conversations of, are you going to upgrade the washing machine with Bluetooth or wireless? And and yeah, but what if my grandmother doesn't know how to use this thing with the thing and all those things? So then when somebody says, ah, but look, what's going to happen with refrigerators, man? Look, people are buying bigger and bigger refrigerators. You know, how do you increase... How do you play with the failure function aspect with refrigerators? And they've done it in an amazing way. They've made two-door refrigerators. What the fuck do you do with two doors? They start putting coffee machines on the doors. That doesn't work. They start putting water vending machines. And they put antibacterial filters. So the refrigerator stays with you for the life, but you keep changing the damn antibacterial filter and the water filter. You know, is failure introduced in this manner that a refrigerator that just probably costs you, Whirlpool makes 350,000 euros a year on these things. You know, 350,000 euros is a lot of money for them. They were producing 180,000 appliances less. They were low by that much. How much the consume has gone down because people just can't buy. So these are just some interesting facts from where I come from. But there's also like this amazing topic that you guys touched upon, which is the social glue of failure. And I have a very, very interesting, a very nice incident of my own, because I was born and brought up in Delhi. And Delhi is a very huge city, but it's very, very badly managed. And so you during the summers, when it's like 45 degrees, people don't have electricity all the time. The government doesn't have electricity to provide to the whole city. So what they do is they do this thing of load shedding. You know, they shed the light and a whole area doesn't have electricity for the whole night. You know, and it's like 45 degrees, or it's in the night it's a bit cooler. So what does the whole family do? The whole family of all the people living, they go and sleep on the roof. You know, but you don't just sleep on the roof. You sit there and then your grandfather tells you, don't be scared. And, you know, I'm going to tell you your stories. And my grandfather was a historian, you know. So I had the kids who would jump wall from the neighbor's kids who would jump wall on the roof. And we would all listen to stories all night and then sleep under the starry skies, you know. This is really beautiful because it's so difficult nowadays. Because all those crazy media scapes and is that you don't really even get to see the night skies. So it was like, I just think that there, that failure was fantastic, and I just wish it happened again and again.
Wow, that's a lovely story. Thanks for sharing that. And I think it brings up one thing that has not been mentioned enough, and that's the positive side of failure. You've talked a lot about how failing is bad, but so often failing can be a good thing. You know, the idea of trial and error. And it's by finding 99 ways how things don't work that we can find maybe one way how it works.
Heather kind of said that thing.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you did mention it, but like 90% of the discussion was about negative failures. I personally think one of the most dangerous trends in today's society is that we are scared of failing. We build a whole structure that says we have to be successful, right? Research at universities, Johannes, you brought that up, right? We are almost not doing basic research anymore. We don't look at how does this stuff, okay, what happens if I poke it? We're trying to build things. We're trying to build things that can work, that a company will pay money for, that we can publish, right? It's publish or perish. So we don't give ourselves room for failure. We don't say, let's study this and let's see if something comes out of it. I tried to be a researcher. I failed. I mean, I stopped doing it because I didn't have room for failure. I only had to produce stuff that, you know, somebody would want to pay money for. And it's by failing that we can maybe find a way forward. And this is why we're here, actually, at this hackerspace. One of the cool things about hackerspaces is that it provides people a way for failing in new ways. Like people come here and they say, I have no idea about electronics, but I want to start tinkering with it. And they'll do like really stupid things. And that's awesome because that's how they learn. And that's how we all together learn. And I wish people would be more willing to try and fail in new and creative ways.
Yeah, that's why it is there. The glory of fuck up. That's really important. And thanks for reminding us, of course. Yeah.
This just reminded me of an anecdote. When I was teaching in Cambodia, some students in Cambodia can do a thesis in their fourth year, undergraduate. And the thing is, the professors tend to be very kind of controlling or concerning. Like one sociology student wanted to do a research project on men who have sex with men, and her professor was like, "Oh no, we don't have them here in this country." Another student wanted to do this sort of original research project in checking to see like if there was if there was like traces of DDT in the river, and they said, well, but if you do that, how will we know? You know, it like we don't know if that's been proven yet. The idea was that students should do research, but they should only do research that has already been done, in order to demonstrate that they can do this research and that it can follow along these basic lines. Because if they do something and it's unexpected, well, we don't know how to deal with that. And so there's, yeah, I think not only in Cambodia, and there's a lack of honesty and integrity when it comes to the prospect of failure.
Yeah, just to talk about failure, just and the successes or the good things that come out of that. I mean, that's. I mean, I started with electronics late, and I've spent. I mean, the first times I started building. I mean, I built the system for Carolee Schneeman, and I had to exhibit it in New York, and it was one failure after another. And the one thing that electronics has taught me is that there's always an answer. And that you actually don't have to panic, and that there's actually a huge community out there. It actually gives me more faith because, I mean, I've touched, you know, connected the positive with the negative, had meltdowns, blown things up, and all sorts of things. But that is how you learn, and that's how you can create these sort of awkward and strange things that sort of house a certain poetry and sort of allow you to think about things differently in the world differently. So I think that there's a huge positive aspect to it, especially as an artist working with these systems and not doing it right, because that allows it to become something that's actually quite special, I think.
I think in 2002 or 2003, there was this huge power outage in the Northeast in North America that took out the power in a lot of major cities, including Toronto, where I was at the time. And it was really quite an amazing thing because everybody just came out, right, and just started wandering around and started like congregating. And it was like really like the world had ended or something like that. We were like the last survivors wandering around the street, and you'd meet each other. And then like in Kensington Market, which is a nice kind of like cool neighborhood in Toronto, there's a little park. And so we all started kind of gathering there. And sooner, like, you know, none of our cell phones worked, like nothing worked, no communication worked. It was just, there was no power. But yet everybody somehow still kind of found each other. And then people would like bring instruments, and this whole kind of party just kind of emerged that nobody had planned in the middle of Kensington Market with like hundreds and hundreds of people, right? And it was going on and on and on for hours. And then all of a sudden, the lights came on. And it was just like, no, everyone was like, oh, society isn't over. Damn. it was really kind of like a really palatable moment of disappointment. It's like, oh, I thought we were just going to go on like this forever, like just hanging out in the park, like playing music and sharing food. And no, now the lights are back on. All right. Okay. So it was really, anyway.
Does anyone have a volcano story?
Volcano story?
Well, why don't you talk about Pompeii?
A volcano story, yeah.
Pompeii.
I mean, if they wouldn't have built it so close to the volcano, and ignored all the signs, that we wouldn't have a preserved Roman city in this whole scale. But I mean, on the landscapes, you can still dig out Roman mosaics, 2,000 years old and still fresh, and yeah.
Yes, if they didn't build it there, we wouldn't have that archaeology.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. There's a lot of great.
There's this like nice saying, Giordano Bruno died for our Sims.
In terms of Pompeii, the other thing that's great about Pompeii is that it preserves all these things that that people didn't write about. You know, like advertisements for here you may find a whorehouse, and
even like the graffiti. You know, the mare's an ass. You know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. That there's all this like underground stuff of like, yeah, you know, screw this guy or this way to a whorehouse or beware of dog, that just sort of zipped under the layer of all of those guys. I was actually asking about the more modern volcano, but that.
Oh, the one in
the Iceland volcano.
Oh, the Iceland volcano. Oh my God, nice.
Actually, it's called Eyjafjallajökull. And Maris and I were stranded in Norway because of that one. So. But yeah.
What happened?
No, actually, it was actually very, very weird because for me it was a reminder how used we have all become that we can travel from A to B instantaneously or like almost instantaneously. We were in Oslo, and then of course all the planes were cancelled. But it didn't take very long until all the train tickets were also sold out because all the people that wanted to go back to Europe had to take the train instead. So then the next city would be take a bus, but then all the buses were sold out as well. And then all the rental cars were sold out as well. So you actually ended up in the place. Unfortunately, we didn't have to go back, so it wasn't a big deal. But it was actually the case that we were in this city, and we, even if we had wanted to, we wouldn't have had a way to get back to Vienna because there was no bus, train, rental car, or airplane. And we could have walked, we could have tried hitchhiking. And actually, I did hear that some kind of spontaneous systems arose. Like people actually started to form car sharing circles, and you know, there was a website where people said, okay, I'm going to be driving through Berlin, so anybody who wants to come with me, please sign up here. And that was also one of the things that I found very, very beautiful, and that gave me hope for humanity, right, to see that. I mean, even when things break down, people will spontaneously find ways how to work around that failure. I mean, we've survived for millions of years without having this modern infrastructure, and we can do it again.
I can just add that it's just really funny because unemployed people starting to drive from A to B just to make a few bucks on getting people from A to B, and it really kind of patched up the system that didn't actually work anymore. It's cleanup time. But the fun thing about this whole volcano story is that this was also a fail in the government to actually correctly assess the situation and shutting down the airspace without having any idea what was going on up there. And they were just saying, let's be super safe and just shut down the whole country. Not what can come out of that. I mean, it's better to be safe, right? And in retrospect, people figure out that maybe this was just a slightly overreaction from the government side and or from the air traffic controller side, and another fail.
I'm from Winnipeg, and we often have a lot of May blizzards and March blizzards and February blizzards, and it often happens. It's just what you made me think of, just like these little smaller communities that leap up out of nowhere, out of necessity, just to get people from point A to point B. And when you have a blizzard, the whole city is shut down. Nothing works. Nothing functions. And then people start pulling out the skidoos, and there's hotlines, and these little smaller communities happen, taking people from point A to point B. And I just think it's really fantastic how that does happen in these communities.
To get back to a pretty tragic thing, 9/11. 9/11 was like a major human tragedy. At the same time, the first people who screamed "Yeah!" were the researchers about climate change and meteorologists, because they were saying, "Fuck yes, there is no air traffic over the entire continent of the United States of America. Yeah, there is no fucking air traffic. We can first ever do research what the air quality is, how a world without airplanes looks like, at least for a week or two or something like that." And there is so incredibly much data now about the climate system without air traffic. They couldn't do that now in Europe because the air was polluted by the volcano ash. They couldn't do that now. But back then, in 2001, they gained so much knowledge about how the atmosphere works just by switching off the air traffic.
That reminds me how the Korean Demilitarized Zone is now actually like this amazing area for wildlife and birds, and because people can't go there. This is the area between North and South Korea, and so you can't go there. There are mines there. There are people who will shoot you. But birds can go there, and plants can grow there. So there are like endangered birds and stuff that have managed to flourish within this tiny strip of contested ground. It's really one of these, you know, curiosities of, you know, unexpected things.
Like checking my semi-functional iPhone. It's already 10 o'clock. We have been talking for a very, very long time. I think we should round it up. Maybe a short statement of each of you, like a last line of commemoration or whatever.
Okay. Everything is only in a state of not having yet failed.
Yeah, mine may be a summary of the statement I made when you asked me originally for that statement about failure, but you didn't mention it was about failure of technology, so I was perhaps more optimistic in my statement than I might normally have been. But it was something like, really, the people do say that the only way you can learn is by failing, but I actually think it's more that the only way you can learn is by trying, and that failing is just a inevitable percentage outcome of, if you keep trying, you're going to fail sometimes. And yes, so you have to do things to learn how to do them, and that's the only way. And so we need to accept failure as a part of that.
I agree. Yeah, no, I think it's actually one of the most important things that we can do. And I think that there's a lot of strength in failure, and especially in an artistic practice, I think it's really worthwhile. Dysfunction, I think, is important.
I've always kind of thought that there's sort of a relationship between creativity in a process and preconception, where that if you're setting out to do something and you know exactly how it's going to turn out, there's not really any point in doing it, right? So unless there is some risk of failure, there's no potential for something to kind of achieve more or express more than you originally had started out. So the Tournament says that about plagiarism, right? That plagiarism is necessary because we need to replace a false statement with a correct statement. I'm paraphrasing, right? And progress and progress demands that, right? So progress demands failure in a sense.
Okay. So and my last statement would be because not too many people know about it, unfortunately. There is this wonderful thing called the Peter Principle that was created or first written down by Peter, Mr. Peter in the 60s. And he pretty much says we are all failing all the time because in very hierarchical societies where it's clear who is the superior, like in the military, there's a major and there's a general and stuff like that. Hierarchical societies have to be battled because they make people unhappy. They make people unhappy because all the people in the hierarchical society are stuck at their level of failure or their level of not being able to grow to the next level. So if there is a major for a long, long, long time, he's probably just too stupid to become a general because he's just stuck at his hierarchical level. And that makes people unhappy. It makes people suffer their whole lives because of that, the structure of the system. And people should just keep in mind, don't let that happen to you. Okay, don't let the system crack you down because you're sitting in some stupid hierarchical intermediary limbo. Okay, so thanks a lot for being here and still listening to us. The stuff will be online, I guess, as MP3 if we didn't fail or if Michi Wohlschlager didn't fail recording it. Thanks a lot. Get a drink. We have a really excellent Red Sturm here. Maybe you want to share it with us. And good night. Bye-bye.